Attention all passengers. The Uber ride for Mark and Jamal's romantic weekend will depart in 4 minutes from Platform 6. Your ride comes with a rolling countryside sunset view and a table seat ideal for playing footsie beneath. Thank you for booking your tickets on Uber.
Trains on Uber.
Have you ever been told your chances of having a baby are almost zero and you felt like your story was already written for you? Today's episode is for anyone who's been through failed cycles, devastating news, or even to the person who feels like their time is running out and they're wondering, is there still hope? Today we're talking about infertility, but not in a way you usually hear about it. We're going deeper. We're going into the cases that most people are told are too far gone. The moments where hope feels fragile and what's actually possible beyond that point. Dr. Sherman Seilber is here. He's one of the most pioneering fertility specialists in the world, and he's been at the forefront of breakthrough procedures like ovarian tissue transplantation, microsurgical infertility treatments, and IVF advancements that have helped people conceive even after being told it wasn't possible. So if you ever felt like giving up, or if you know someone who has, this conversation might completely change how you see what is possible. So Dr. Sherman, it's so good to have you here. Thank you so much for being here.
Well, thank you very much. It's really a pleasure. And I hope by the end of this podcast, people will understand that no matter how difficult the case or how extreme you have to go, you can always have a baby. That is the most important message of hope. But I will explain details and cases that will exemplify that. I made that statement in a book that I wrote, How to Get Pregnant with a New Technology. That was the original book in the 1990s, actually. And, I give some fun examples. We had a patient, a lovely, lovely woman and her husband. Well, they were great. We didn't know why they were not getting pregnant. There was idiopathic infertility. And we were able to get a lot of blastocysts frozen to transfer to her. And we did 3 transfers and she didn't get pregnant. So, you know, statistically, even with 3 good blastocysts in a young woman, there's about a 4 or 5% chance none of them will have taken, like a 95% chance that she'll have at least one baby from that. But you never think you're in that group. You think it's hopeless. So she asked us to transfer the embryos that were remaining to a gestational surrogate. And we said, fine. I mean, there's no argument against it. If that's what the woman wants, let's try it. Maybe there's some mysterious problem with the receptivity of the uterus. So we transferred 2 embryos to a gestational surrogate. She got pregnant with twins and delivered healthy, happy twins. And so the patient was happy. She had her twins, but she had 1 blastocyst left. So 6 years later, she said to us, okay, I don't want to just leave that alone. You know, she got pregnant and had a baby. So there was no real uterine receptivity problem. We proved with her, it was just statistics. There was a 5% chance that even with 3 good blastocyst transfers, she wouldn't be pregnant. And yet she could be pregnant with the next one. Every time it would be 60% chance. And she finally got pregnant. And it wasn't really that she had uterine lack of receptivity. It was just statistics and odds. We had a woman who was 42 years old. Who knew that she had to store up a lot of embryos statistically to have a good chance of having a baby. Drove her husband crazy because she came all the way from Europe. I won't identify where. She was a very famous businesswoman. And she had calculated, because she was a real numbers person, that she needed to collect 20 day 3 embryos or 10 blastocysts, freeze them, and then she would have a very, very high chance of getting pregnant. So she came back many times. I mean, she came back 8 times. And finally, with her few number of eggs, we managed to store up 20-day 3 embryos for her. And finally, she said, okay, let's do the embryo transfers. She got pregnant with the first embryo transfer and it twins. And that was it. So all the other embryos were a waste. And they could be donated, of course. So there are so many of these interesting, weird cases that demonstrate the point. Statistically, it's almost never a zero chance. Now, of course, what if a woman has run out of eggs completely? Well, with donor eggs, she may not like the idea at first, but with donor eggs, the chance of getting pregnant again is the same as if she were 25 years old and had young eggs. But it sounds spooky to patients. But what I like to explain to them is, yeah, no one wants donor eggs. They want their own DNA. However, since 1986, we've never had an unhappy case with donor eggs. Why would that be? There are many parents that are unhappy with their children. So how could that possibly be that with donor eggs, we wouldn't have any unhappy cases yet? The reason is this. We can easily match for background and appearance, and that isn't that important. What couples really care most about, what women care most about, is personality, character, intelligence, emotional stability, and bonding with her as mother. But those five features we found are not in the DNA. They're very intangible, and they arise from how you interact with the baby in the first 2 or 3 years of life.
Right.
So it's their baby. And I challenge them sometimes 20 years later when their kid is graduating college and they send me a card and they're very proud. And I say, well, you know, that really isn't your DNA. And they say, Doc, you think I'm stupid? I know it's not my DNA, but it is my baby. So donor eggs are always an option. What if you have no uterus? Well, in most countries, it's a real problem because gestational surrogacy is not allowed. In the United States, it's not a problem. There are 20,000 women in the United States who'd love to carry a baby. They've already had children and they love pregnancy, but they don't want any more children. So we have no difficulty finding a gestational surrogate that will carry the baby for you. And the laws are very good in the United States that the intended mother is the mother. The gestational surrogate basically has no rights, and she signs them away when she agrees to do this. And so it's a very, very safe alternative. Now, most people want to carry their own baby, but what if they can't? Well, gestational surrogacy in the United States, we don't need to do uterine transplants, which are incredibly complex and scary, dangerous procedures. I mean, we can do it. We're microsurgical masters for many years, but I don't recommend that, even though we could do it. Gestational surrogacy is just such a safer enterprise, really. So I'm just giving the impossible examples. Everybody can have a baby.
Yeah.
No matter how serious or difficult your problem is. And maybe you can ask me some specific questions now, but I wanted to just start out letting you know that I hope by the end of this podcast, people who've given up hope will not give up hope anymore.
I mean, I commend you. You deal with a very sensitive subject, because when a woman comes to see you or a couple comes to see you and they've been told that they're completely infertile, they probably feel incredibly hopeless and they feel like they don't know what's going to happen, but they don't have much hope. And it sounds like after speaking with you that they can regain that hope because so many people want, like you said, their own children. What do you think are some of the most common misconceptions that people have, perhaps after failed IVF or after multiple losses?
Well, there's a lot of them, a lot of misconceptions. One misconception I emphasized already is statistically, if you have a 60% chance of having a baby with every embryo transfer, then that means with 3 embryo transfers, you only have a 95% chance of having at least one baby. You might even have more babies. And actually, after 4 embryo transfers, if you're still not pregnant, there's still that would give you a 98% chance of having at least one baby.
Right.
2% of women are going to fall into that category that after 4 transfers of good embryos, and this is a young woman, someone who's under 30, she's still not going to have gotten pregnant yet, but that doesn't mean she won't get pregnant. And so that's one of the best examples is don't be fooled by statistics. But the other interesting thing is I'll give you other examples. There are girls that are born with Turner syndrome. That means that they are born with no ovaries. They're XO girls, and they're very, very frustrated because they don't even make hormones. They don't ovulate. They don't menstruate. There's no ovaries. Well, of course, donor eggs is an option for sure, like I've mentioned. However, we have another option for women that have no eggs. We can transplant ovary tissue from a donor. Now, usually it's a sister or a mother even. Mother, if she's a young girl and her mother's young, like under 35, we can transfer tissue from her mother to her. And it really works spectacularly. The immunosuppression to prevent rejection is very, very safe. We use just anti-thymocyte globulin. That might be something people don't understand. But basically, we avoid steroids, and that's the killer. And so it's a very, very safe immunosuppression. It's unobtrusive. It's very simple immunosuppression, and it prevents rejection. And sooner or later, the evidence is that we could take them off the immunosuppression and they wouldn't reject because they'll get permanent tolerance. So this is an option, and it's not a complicated or difficult surgery. We originally did it microvascular, the way we would do a uterine transplant. However, now we found for the ovary, we don't need that. We can just take a piece of ovary tissue and graft it like a skin graft onto the area where the ovary should have been, or where the dead ovary is, or the ovary without eggs is located. And it takes just like a skin graft. They ovulate normally. It's a simple, safe operation, and they get pregnant naturally. They don't even need IVF.
It's incredible. What changes have you seen over the years? I mean, you've been practicing for so many years. You've written like so many books. You have 5 different textbooks. So what do you think the biggest things that have changed over the years is at this point?
Well, when we started originally, that was even before IVF. And we could do microsurgery to reverse vasectomies, reverse tubal ligations, and we could do microsurgery. And then eventually I did testicle transplantation and then fallopian tube transplantation. There was a lot of microsurgery. Well, IVF, when it first came about, seemed like it was going to be very difficult and only work for 2% of women with infertility. But it became simplified. And it started out with a procedure we call GIFT, where we take sperm and eggs and put them into the fallopian tube. Very simple. Anybody could do it. You don't need an IVF lab to do it. And that was remarkably successful, but it was surgical, and it wasn't as good as IVF. At this stage, what's happened is the culture systems, media are so safe. The laboratory protocols are so well established. We have perfect clean air that's very necessary, and we didn't realize that a long time ago. So culture conditions are almost as good as the uterus itself. And so IVF has really improved dramatically in terms of culture. But one other thing that I have to mention, we couldn't do anything about no sperm or low sperm counts.
Okay.
Well, I'll tell you another interesting story. I saw a patient in 1985, many patients like this, but this is an interesting story. We did a testicle biopsy because he had no sperm. We wanted to see what the problem was. It was a condition called maturation arrest, and there was nothing we could really do. I said, you know, we don't have any medical treatment for maturation arrest, and you're just not going to be able to have children unless you use donor sperm. Well, it's part of their whole religion that they weren't going to use donor sperm. So they went without babies for 10 years. And then I went to my oldest son's wedding, and he was one of the persons that was invited. And my son didn't know that he was a patient, and I didn't know he was at the wedding, you know. But I'm skipping ahead. Because a year before my son's wedding, I had sent a letter out to him and every other man with no sperm. And I said, guess what? Now we can retrieve sperm from your testicle microsurgically. We can inject the sperm into the egg with ICSI. And even if you only have 1 or 2 sperm, you don't need 10,000 sperm. You don't need 10 million sperm. You don't need 100 million sperm. All you need is 1 or 2 sperm. We can pick it up by the tail under the microscope and inject it directly into the egg. So come and we'll do this. And so he was one of the first to come, and we found sperm and injected it into his wife's eggs, and he had a healthy baby. And I was very happy. But what I didn't realize is he knew my son, and he was invited to that wedding. And so I saw him at the wedding. And he came up to me. I said, oh, my gosh, how's the baby? 1 year old. He said, yes. I said, you remember I sent you that letter 10 years ago saying that you couldn't have a baby? He said, yes. But he's a very religious man. He said, yes, I know that. But God had different plans. His feeling was God had different plans. But it's just another example that you think it's hopeless, but it isn't. So we developed ICSI in 1992, 1993. And it became really perfected by 1994. And now there is virtually no male infertility that we can't treat. There is a tiny category where we don't find any sperm, but it's a very tiny category. And then along came vitrification. And that meant instead of this terrible slow freezing process of embryos, we could freeze embryos with abandon, with no fear that we were going to be hurting them. Well, maybe there was 0.5% or less chance that you might have a problem. But basically, that meant that if we stimulate women that would be in danger of hyperstimulation syndrome, It's not a problem. We freeze the embryos without even caring about it and transfer them 3 months later when everything is very safe. And we've eliminated the one real danger of IVF. The one terrible danger was hyperstimulation syndrome. We don't have that anymore because we can freeze the embryos safely. So there's just been so much progress, and you never for sure where it's going to come from. I'll give you an example right now. I hope I'm not talking too long. We have figured out how to in vitro mature eggs. When we take out ovary tissue, ovaries, like for cancer patients, to freeze the ovary before they're sterilizing chemotherapy, and we dissect the cortex out, we get immature eggs. But we can mature them in 1 or 2 days to become good, fertile eggs. And so that's something we develop, and we're proud of it. But guess what? What about women who aren't cancer patients? You don't want to take out the ovary to do this in vitro maturation of eggs. Well, I'm giving you an example. If you never know where the best next great idea will come from. And in Vietnam, the doctors there figured out how to aspirate eggs from ovaries that haven't been stimulated, from little tiny follicles with no stimulation. They get those eggs. We do IVM with those eggs. We get mature eggs, and they can go through IVF without even being stimulated. No medications.
Wow. There's been so many developments. Absolutely incredible.
And we would have never thought that.
Something
came,
an amazing career.
Yeah, it came from Vietnam. And, you know, and when we have to do surgery like that, we always worried about pain after surgery and the complications of pain. Well, now we inject the operative area before the patient wakes up with a combination of ropivacaine, toradol, and morphine, regularly available medications. They bind to the pain receptors for 3 days, so the patient has no pain when they wake up. Guess where that idea came from? It's revolutionized surgery, so we can do almost everything as an outpatient now. Nothing has to be as an inpatient. And it came from the University of Cork in Cork, Ireland. You never know where the next fantastic advance is going to come.
Yeah. I have a question for you, Dr. Salver. Is age truly a limiting factor? Is it as limiting as people believe it is, or is there more nuance there?
Interesting. Well, age certainly affects the egg. We know that after age 35, the eggs become less fertile. And we even know as the woman gets older, she's losing eggs. She loses about 1,000 eggs every month. Started out with 400,000 eggs as a teenager, and by the time she's 51, she's completely run out of eggs.
Right.
But also the fertility of the eggs begin to go down slightly in your 20s, but after age 35, it goes down fairly dramatically. Well, we can use a procedure we call mini-IVF to stimulate those follicles so that we get the best quality eggs. And we're getting very good pregnancy rates now in women who are over 35 and even over 40. And so that's a big advance. But what if they've completely run out of fertile eggs? Well, like I say, we have ovary transplantation. We have donor eggs as a possibility. We have gestational surrogacy if their uterus is no good or if they actually have had a hysterectomy or were born without a uterus. And so we can solve every problem. But you brought up age. And we have women, our oldest woman that we've gotten pregnant was 63 years old.
Oh, wow.
But that wasn't with donor eggs. That was with eggs that we had, embryos we had frozen 30 years earlier, and she had babies already. And she had a leftover embryo, and she just didn't want to leave that embryo alone. So let's transfer it. And believe it or not, she had a healthy baby. Now, we wouldn't transfer to a 63-year-old unless she was extremely healthy, got an okay for her doctor, had a good extended family in case anything should happen to her. I mean, we do a real social service evaluation to make sure that this is a smart thing to do. You know, nowadays, so many people are living to 100 because of preventive medicine, good diet, this woman is very healthy, and I'm quite sure she'll be there when her kid graduates college.
Incredible. That's incredible.
She may even have grandchildren from this kid because so many people are living to 100 and have all their marbles. Now, I'll give you an example. I have all my marbles, and I swim aggressively, and I swim a mile every other night. And, you know, I'm really very, very fit, and I'm a chess master, and I'm 84 years old. And
incredible.
I'm planning to be this way till I'm 104.
Good for you.
I'll probably hang up my shingles when I'm 24. I mean, 100. See, I said
that's, and I believe you. You definitely are very youthful. I know there are so many advancements in technology when it comes to even hormone replacement therapy. And so are those types of things helping with your therapy? Are they kind of complementing each other? And another question to go with that, are there options for women who've gone through early menopause or have lost their ovarian function?
Well, that is a fantastic point. I'm glad you brought it up because I failed to bring that up. You know, menopause really is a disease. It's terrible because your bones become weak. You become subject to bad fractures if you trip or fall, and you become frail. And that happens because of a lack of estrogen. And men, they don't have to worry about it because the testosterone does the same thing for our bones that estrogen does for your bones. But menopause is not nice. It also causes the vagina to get dry, which means painful intercourse, but it also means recurrent urinary infections. And now we know that it even can cause a higher risk of dementia or heart disease. So menopause is a disease. Now, there was a unfortunate study in 2002 that implied that hormone replacement therapy during menopause causes a higher risk of cancer. Mm-hmm. And so women who were on hormone therapy got terrified. Doctors got terrified of lawsuits, and it stopped. Instead of 60% of women being on hormone therapy, it went down to 2%. And that was a public health disaster. And the people that wrote that terribly flawed paper, I think, should be really ashamed of themselves because it had a gigantic negative impact on women's health. Mm-hmm. And luckily, 10 years later, that was proven to be a fallacious study. And we know that, if anything, hormone therapy will improve health, lessen the risk of cancer, lessen the risk of heart disease, prevent bone decay, allow sex to be a happy event instead of a painful, miserable one, and actually prevent recurrent urinary infections, which are just terrible in older women. And, you know, you used to see women who managed to make it to age 70 or 80 on the cruise ships without their husband who passed away. They'd always have that so-called buffalo hump.
Right. I mean,
they look terrible. They look frail. And that's because they had no estrogen to make their bones strong. And so you avoid frailty by being on hormone replacement. Now, it can be sometimes maybe a lot of trouble because you have to remember to take the pills. Well, there's another solution to this. It sounds very extreme, but it's really very easy. And I have a number of patients who are doctors, women who are doctors, that did this. So you can take out an ovary. And when you do that and you reduce the follicle reserve, the rate of primordial follicle recruitment goes down as the ovarian reserve goes down. So the Japanese showed this in a big study, Yasui et al., than 24,000 women, that if you take out the ovary, instead of menopause occurring at age 51, it occurs at an average age of 49.5 years. So it has hardly any effect on the age of menopause because the rate of follicle recruitment goes down.
Interesting.
So you put an ovary or a part of an ovary, freeze the cortex, and then when she goes through menopause, you can transplant back one-fifth of that cortex and leave the other four-fifths still frozen. And that's going to last for another 12 years. So she will not be in menopause until she's 60. But guess what? When she's 60, you take another little piece, another fifth, 20% of that frozen ovary, and you put that back. And she'll go till she's 70. And you'll have enough tissue to keep her from being in menopause until she's 100 years old, and she doesn't need to be on any medication. Okay, now she may not want periods anymore. Not a big deal. You put in a progesterone IUD, she won't have periods, but she will have completely normal hormone function and she won't have to remember to be on pills. Now, there is another advantage to it. Being on hormone replacement is very important for the estrogen. Really, really important. However, testosterone production begins to go down also.
Mm-hmm.
So sex drive goes down. Whereas if they have their normal hormone production from normal ovary, they will be normal, completely normal, in terms of sex drive, in terms of women have one-tenth the testosterone that men have, but that's enough. And they don't want as much as we have. Testosterone is an overpowering toxic hormone in the sense that, you know, you don't see women doing crazy things like men are doing, you know, and partly that's because they don't have this massive over-aggressiveness that can be caused by testosterone. But they have 1/10 the testosterone we have, but that's all they need. But they have nothing after age 60. Ovary tissue, they'll have normal testosterone production.
Incredible.
So we don't have to be a hormone replacement, but we do want to avoid menopause.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. That's all women are talking about is how much they're struggling with the early menopause and menopause and how difficult and challenging it is. It's like women completely transform when they finally get the help they need and they lose that anxiety and they're not depressed anymore and they feel like themselves. It's really a shame to see, you know, really successful women kind of go downhill just because of biology, right? When it doesn't have to be that way. So it's really interesting, the work that you're doing.
And unfortunately, many of them are frightened into thinking the hormones will have a negative effect. All you're doing is replacing normal hormone production.
Right.
And you might say, well, but it's not natural for women to have hormones after age 50. Well, I mean, come on. 13,000 years ago, everybody died by age 35 or 40.
Right.
And so the ovary lasted as long as it really had to last. But now that we have the benefit of living to age 100, we need to be normal. And that means having hormone production.
That's incredible. Can you explain some more of the newer or lesser known procedures that are giving people a second chance?
Well, okay. So we are doing research with the Japanese, particularly Dr. Hayashi and his group in Japan, and with Mander Clark, who's in America, UCLA. And we're using stem cells. Now, because of the work of the Japanese, we can now make stem cells. Nobel Prize was already awarded for this. We can now make stem cells just from a skin biopsy. Take a little skin biopsy and you culture the fibroblasts from that skin in 4 genes. And by the way, you can buy these genes commercially. There's nothing special about it. And you incubate it in these 4 genes and lo and behold, you have stem cells. And the genes are the same genes for almost any species. And so it's very easy now to make stem cells. We don't, embryonic stem cells, we don't need embryos to do that. We can just make it. We have embryonic stem cells from women that are in their 50s and 60s and men who are azoospermic, we have stem cells. And so that's easy. But then by incubating in the proper genes to recreate what happens in the early embryo, we can turn those stem cells into what we call primordial germ cells. And that's the beginning of making eggs and sperm.
Okay.
Now, you incubate those primordial germ cells in what we call fetal granulosa cells. And it's like magic. Those fetal granulosa cells then will turn the PGCs into mature eggs. And you can make a baby from that. Now, we've succeeded in the mice to make baby mice from the mother's skin cells. And really healthy baby mice. And we're going to succeed, I'm sure, pretty soon with the rhinoceros, which went extinct, as the white rhinoceros went extinct. And but in the humans, it may take a while, but the Japanese, we're working on it. We're helping them with tissue, but they're really doing the science. And what you really need is not just fetal granulosa cells, because, you know, it's very hard to get that in the human, unlike in experimental animals. So you have to make fetal granulosa cells. Well, what they've shown in mice is that you can make fetal granulosa cells also from stem cells just by incubating in different genes. And so without any fetal granulosa cells now in the mouse, you can make a healthy baby mouse just from the mother's skin biopsy.
Incredible. Yeah.
So that we do, it's species specific though. So now we've got to find the transcripts in the human that will convert stem cells into fetal granulosa cells in the human, because it is species specific for that. And I'm not the scientist, I'm a clinician, but the scientists working on this in Japan figure this could be 5 or 10 years away. And just think about it then, instead of for IVF having to do an egg retrieval, you can just do a skin biopsy.
That's incredible. I was just going to ask you, what do you see for the future of all of this? How are things going to be changing over the next decade or two?
I think in the future, no matter what, let's say a 38-year-old woman, let's give an example. So she can do IVF and her success rate will not be as high as a 25-year-old woman. Skin biopsy using this technology of stem cells will give her the same success rate as a 25-year-old woman, even if she's 38. So a 38-year-old woman would be better off having a skin biopsy than having an egg retrieval.
Wow.
That's pretty amazing. And then a 55-year-old woman will not have to think about donor eggs, because when you make stem cells, you're basically rejuvenating them. You're making them embryonic cells. And so these are very, by the way, these are very young eggs you're making from stem cells. So they'll be very fertile, even though it came from a 55-year-old woman.
Wow, that's so exciting. I feel like humans are going to live so much longer now. And I feel like anyone out there listening will have so much more hope. Because like I said at the beginning of this episode, when someone's told that they're infertile, it's a very defeating thing. And women and their partners and husbands feel really defeated by that. So I'd like to ask you this. What should someone do if they've been told that there's nothing more that can be done in order to help them with their fertility?
Well, you know, I want to, first place, they can call us up. I do free Zoom consults for anyone. Now, if they wind up having treatment, of course, there are fees for the treatment. But I can give anybody, I love, as you can see, I love helping and talk to people and talking about them. Otherwise, why would I be practicing medicine at 84 years of age? And so I'll tell them what they have to do and give them hope. If they want to be treated with us, fine. But otherwise, at least they'll know what they can do. And hope to me is not a strategy. It's not really a plan. I will give them a plan, and we can call it hope, but it's not just blind hope. I can tell them exactly what we can do.
Just yeah, like I was going to say, there's different kinds. There's empty promises, and there's, you know, fake optimism. But when you're backing it up with science and, you know, other patients' stories, that's the kind of hope that people are looking for.
Yeah, exactly right. That kind of hope is truly a plan, and plans are what they want.
What about for someone who maybe can't see you, but they want to ask their doctor about options? What are some questions that people should be asking their doctors that they usually don't?
Well, okay, first of all, doctors can be very defensive. I mean, they've gone through so many years of training and so much education, it can become egotistical. They may not want to be, but it can happen. And if they're threatened in a way, they can be defensive. So the important thing is the doctor is sensitive to your feelings, but as a patient, you've got to be sensitive to her or his feelings also.
Yeah, everyone's human, right?
And just nicely say, you know, I don't want to give up, doctor. Do you think there are other options that you don't provide that might be helpful? Now, what you do want to avoid, though, is silly things, because many doctors, if presented with that, will put you on dietary supplements, which aren't going to make any difference. Sometimes they put you on things like DHEA if you're older, which is really a male hormone and doesn't help older eggs. But there's a myth all over the place that DHEA may help, but it doesn't. All the studies show it doesn't. Or they may put you on a growth hormone, which absolutely doesn't help. There are a lot of sort of supplements and things that are done just to try to make the patient feel we're doing something that don't really, really work. So avoid that. But nonetheless, there are things that do work, like I've talked about already. Now, they may be extreme. We're not ready yet to use stem cells. We will be in 5 or 10 years. And if the woman is 20, she might be willing to wait. But if she's 40 years old, then she really doesn't want to wait 10 years, although that will be the ultimate solution for her. But it doesn't matter, because like I've explained before, if they're willing to look at it objectively and look at the history and even talk to patients that we can have them talk to, they'll know that using donor eggs is not a bad thing. It'll be their baby, even if it's not their DNA. And I've explained to you why. You know, Conrad Lorenz won the Nobel Prize in the 90s for showing imprinting, which means that if you took a baby goose and you took away the baby's mother, and Conrad Lorenz would pretend like he was the mother, the baby goose would think it's a human. It would follow Conrad Lorenz around.
Wow.
That is the rudest form of imprinting. But there is a subtle form of imprinting that Burton White described in his book, The First 3 Years of Life. And that is everything. And that's the nature of the interaction between caregiver and child, between parents and child. In the first years of life, the brain is really growing like it'll never grow again, and is developing in a tremendous way. And it's not as though you can program a child to be what you want the child to be. That doesn't work. That just creates a violation of autonomy and rebellion.
I wonder, like,
But a good quality interaction and an interesting interaction with a child to encourage their curiosity and to give them a sense of security, they identify you're the mother. You know, that's all
right.
Doesn't matter what
that
the
connection.
Yeah. And so if I would make sure that women can talk to other women that have gone through this, and I'd explain it. And most women will say, we've got to try our own eggs first. But if that doesn't work, then donor eggs will be very, very happy. We've never had an unhappy case. And that's so strange because many parents are unhappy with their children. But that's usually because the first several years of life was a time of turmoil for them, or identity crisis, or so many other things they had to take care of that they didn't realize how crucial that interaction was in the first 3 years of life.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, thank you so much for being on the show and for talking about not giving up hope. I would love for you to let the audience know one thing that you wish every patient understood before they gave up.
Well, that's great. I think every patient should know that there is no logical reason to give up. I hope, based on this podcast, they'll understand that, but I'm glad to explain it to them individually.
Amazing. Well, thank you so much for the work that you're doing. It's absolutely amazing. You're so needed out there, and it must be so rewarding to help so many people, especially when they're coming in and they've lost all hope. Like, I can't imagine how amazing that must feel to turn that around for a couple and you know, meet their child a year from now. It must be amazing.
It is a great feeling. I love it. I love all the Christmas cards and Hanukkah cards and graduation cards and birthday cards that I get all the time. And it's such a good feeling because ultimately, what every human being wants is to transmit themselves into the next generation. And this is the way you do it.
Absolutely. Thanks again for being here. And thank you to our audience for tuning in. If this conversation spoke with you, or if you want someone you love to hear this, please send it to them. And always remember that a diagnosis is not always a destiny. And sometimes the story you think is over is actually just waiting for the right person, the right approach, or the right moment to shift. So if you know someone who needs this message, please share this episode with them. And as always, we will link all of the doctor's information in the show notes so you can explore what options might be available for you, including that conversation that he's offering via Zoom to chat about your options, because hope is not something we're supposed to lose. Thanks again for tuning in, everyone. Stay tuned for the next episode. Bye for now.